That moment when you find out your cousin's wedding is not the weekend of the Cowboys game. Oh, Sports Radio 94, WIP.
That moment when you realize you might have missed another edition of WIP Sunday, but you haven't. My name's Peter Solomon. My guest this morning, David E. Weishaupt. Or Weishaupt?
Weishaupt.
All right, thank you, David. David's got a new novel.
David's good.
228. All right, David, tell me about 228.
It's an interesting adventure for me because it gave me an opportunity to go back a little bit and think about things that I did and how they affected my life and things of that sort. But it's mostly started out as I tried to develop a day-by-day sequence. When you go to war, it's a war novel. It takes place in the 60s in Vietnam, but it's more of a mystery and maybe adventure novel, I guess you could call it. It's a product of some entertainment. Those who are probably against the war could see some entertainment in it. Those who were for it probably could see some experiences that they could share as well. But it's an attempt to just to provide a young man goes to war and here's his experiences. Somewhat fictionalized, I'd say it's the old classic 80-20, 20% probably real, 80% is fiction. But it's an attempt to give another perspective to the war. I mean, Vietnam was not a lighthearted adventure, obviously, but as anybody who served with other people there know that there were moments of great joy and moments of excitement and moments of sadness. And so I kind of put my perspective there. It's a hard war to talk about.
Amen to that, and we still don't talk about it enough.
That's right. That's probably right.
What is the title?
We're coming up on some anniversaries now. So it's now coming up. PBS just had the last days of Vietnam. It's kind of interesting to see that perspective because many of us at that time really weren't paying attention to it. So now with passage of time, we can perhaps spend a little more time thinking about what happened there.
What does the title 228 mean?
It's my unit there. I was assigned to, I was at Fort Gordon, Georgia, teaching in the Officers' Candidate School, and my number came up. So I was heading out to join the 228 Signal Company with 11 other officers. I was the only one who stayed there, and I stayed there for my entire time. My 12 months in Vietnam, I served with the 228 Signal Company. Beginning as, I guess, a platoon leader, going up to, at the end, because of emergency leave, I was company commander.
On some level, though, you must have thought, what am I doing here? I'm a teacher, not a soldier.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no. Matter of fact, that was a question everybody asked. And I was teaching. I was teaching, and I was called active duty in May. And by some ability on the part of the superintendent, he got me delayed until probably, I think, sometime in August I left. There was a lot of guys. There was many people. Many GIs were married who had been drafted. I had a commission, so I was called active duty with that, but I was commissioned in 63. These are like ancient times now. But I didn't go on active duty until 1965, and I didn't get to Vietnam until 1966, which were early years in Vietnam. So it was a little bit different than someone who's serving there maybe in 1970, 71, after Tet. Tet was kind of if you were there before Tet, you had one kind of war. Probably after Tet, it was another kind of war. And depending on what you're doing. I mean, I was in the Signal Corps, so, we were in dangerous places, but we weren't doing sustained combat operations and things of that sort. We had units that were doing it. We supported the Korean troops that were in Vietnam, and they were very active in their activities. So depending on where you were, where at the time, where you were driving to, where you were transporting people, where you were being changed in terms of locations and so on. So it's not a friendly area for, in most cases, although people were very friendly and they welcomed you. And so it's kind of a really mixed bag of experiences.
Okay.
That's a question to everybody. I mean, if you're talking about anti-war, there is no stronger movement of anti-war probably than in many, many places over there. People, you literally counted the days that you got home. It's short-timers' calendars in which you fill in the blanks for each of the day you were there.
Mm. Briefly, without giving away too much, the plot of 228.
Well, it's interesting. What I started out to do was a kind of a diary of my experiences, but nobody's interested in that. So we shifted over. My sons and I talked about my wife. We said, well, what can we do with it? You know, we shared it with a couple of publishers, and thank you, but no thank you. And so we finally moved into a mystery mode. I'm kind of a mystery buff, and going back to Sherlock Holmes and whatever. But so what we tried to do is develop a mystery. And what I did is I used my time there as kind of the structure. And the characters are built around some of the guys I served with. And so what we tried to do is we built in actually when I got there, there was a murder in the unit because there were two guys arguing with each other. But I built around that murder and the experiences there. And it was a lot of drug trafficking and CIA and so on. So we merge that all together, and we put a collective mind together, and we come up with a series of activities and a series of adventures and a series of incidences, some real, some not so real, some mixed or real and created, and come up with this mystery. Involves jade, drugs, arms, and so we thought we had a pretty good package, and we got it published, and now we're republishing it with Amazon because the world has changed drastically in the last 20 years in terms of publishing. So we got it out, and we got it out in Kindle. And so we've had some good responses. I'm in a professional career, and it's kind of a nice common topic to talk about. I think it illustrates, too, that it was not such a terrible... you know, every American did not do a lot of terrible things in Vietnam. I think it's an experience of how many people were there, had some positive experiences with people, and grew and developed as a result of it, and got better, became better people for it. So I think it's a mix of a lot of things. It's also it's a chance for me to vent and explore and think about things as well as a veteran.
What was Vietnam like, both when you were there and in the book?
Well, I think one of the things is that it becomes pretty obvious to I guess, maybe 80% of the guys who served there. Well, there were some women at that time. You know, it was a different army at that time. We were an all-male army, and women serving in the military were nurses. There were some auxiliary people in the Red Cross and things of that sort. So it was primarily, you know, the male experience. When I say guys, I literally do mean guys. But it's the experience of the country was, the cover of the book has a Buddha's face on it. And, of course, the country is replete with Buddhas throughout the country. In the Trang, where I was at, we had this, I bet, 10-story-high white Buddha that was beautiful. How it stayed that way and how it got built, no one seemed to know, but it was right in the middle of town. It was beautiful. And that's probably an example of the country. The country is a beautiful country in many ways. And the people were very, very friendly, very nice. And the camaraderie and the development of, you know, being with a group of soldiers for a period of time was a very positive experience. We had some terribly dangerous times, and they just tested us and, you know, provided us such an experience to really show our humanity, so to speak. But it's a lot of different wars. I don't know how many millions of men served or men and women served there, there are probably that many different stories. Everybody had their own story. And that's probably true of most of us, that we all have a different story. We all have the same story in some ways, but we all have some experiences that are different. And so this gave me an opportunity to do a little bit of that as well.
Now, was that...
Everybody asks you, what did you do there? How'd you do it? Why'd you do it? Why'd you go? But those are questions everybody asked each other there, too.
Well, why did you go?
Why did I go?
Yeah.
Well, I grew up in a family that went. I had two brothers, both served in the military, so I don't think it was a choice. And also, let me get a little bit more specific. Go back to 1963, 64, 65. We were still in that post-World War II era in Korea where, you know, it was an honorable thing to do. And it wasn't until probably I came home in 1967, and, you know, we were having urban riots. Disruption was very strong, and of course that was, then Tet popped up in January of 68. So the attitude was, you know, a little bit different and a little bit harsher in many ways. And so, but even at that time, when I came home on leave, I never wore my uniform because it just started conversations you didn't want to have.
Well, you certainly could have made a decision to relocate to Canada.
Yes, I guess I could. But I guess it just wasn't in my system at that time as well. I mean, it was an attitude. And also, I had made a decision in 1963 to accept the commission. So when you know, that was an agreement I made, so I had to fulfill it. And I thought there were many people like that, really mixed feelings. It was very confusing. You know, you'd see the peace sign all over the place on uniforms, off uniforms. If you watch Full Metal Jacket, that's a pretty good depiction of doing an honorable thing, like being in the military in somewhat dishonorable circumstances, you know, and it really... That's what led to confusion for many Vietnam veterans. Why'd I go? Why didn't I do something else? Could I have done something else? Would others have accepted it? That kind of thing. So it's a little different today in terms of veterans. Not that it's not easy, that's not difficult to make transitions back. But it was particularly difficult there because of it was a draftee military at that time as well. 80% of the units probably had people who were drafted and had accepted their required, you know, the assignment to fulfill their military service. And it posed some, you know, many personal problems internally about what we should be doing. And it showed up sometimes. You had to be very careful about what you were doing in terms of people understanding why you were going to carry out this particular task. And it took a little bit more explanation. There was a lot of it was called fragging. If they thought you were not working to their benefit, you know, people would take action against you. Some was very dramatic, you know, the idea of rolling a grenade under a tent and things of that sort. That was, you know, that was always one of those things that everybody talked about and personally never saw or never had that, you know, those kinds of experiences, but they were there. And GIs never, you know, they would question, say, why are we doing this? And it was a good chance. I think in many ways tested the officer to why are we doing it? Why are we going there? Why are we taking out this task? Why are we not doing this? I think in many ways it gave people the second thought about maybe we ought not to be doing this.
And you're listening to WIP Sunday. My name's Peter Solomon. It's 94 WIP Sports Radio. My guest this morning, David Weishattle, his new book, 228. David, you stay with me. I've got to run a few commercials. We'll be back in just a bit.
This is Philadelphia's sports station. Sports Radio 94 WIP.
And we're back on WIP Sunday. My name's Peter Solomon. And my guest this morning, David Weishattle, his new book, 228. All right, David, how do you compare what you went through and what your hero goes through in 228 with what you see and hear about today with Afghanistan and the Middle East?
Well, you know, there's an old, and I don't know what the source is, but, you know, war can be very boring at times. There's a lot of sitting around waiting, waiting for things to happen, waiting for things to do, waiting for the next operation, whatever. So there is a lot of that, and a lot of times it's filled with probably things you shouldn't be doing. But that happens. So, you know, that's how you pick up bad habits with drinking and drugs and things of that sort, because you're looking to fill a vacuum that's kind of existing at this particular moment, and you don't know what's going to happen next. So it's kind of the moment. And that there are just moments of very high level of excitement or challenge or whatever, and difficulties, the threats of things happening, things actually happening. Sometimes the threat was more vivid than the actual thing that happened. We were on an island, so we were kind of isolated. We had an engineering unit at the bottom of this kind of a mountain island, and at the top we had an artillery. We were right in the middle. And, of course, we'd always hear stories about people getting snipered off a bulldozer working on the road. We'd have, you know, approaches by who knew who was, whether it was just somebody, a village at the bottom of the hill who was curious about what was going on, whether actually someone who is trying to plan an attack. After I left, we were attacked, the island was. But during my time period there, we just had threats of it and were able to either be prepared for it or prevent it from happening. So it's really today and a great deal. If you look at what's happened in Iraq and Afghanistan and other places, it's a lot of similarities. Matter of fact, 228 was reactivated and was in Kuwait for a while. But I guess it's deactivated again. It has a history that goes back to being activated in the Philippines just before the Japanese took it over. So I think everybody was captured in the Philippines at that time. And then I think it was reactivated once again, and it was reactivated for Vietnam. So there's a lot of waiting around. There's a lot of anticipation. When things happen, you just got to be ready when they happen. It's a totally different military today in the sense of technology. The amount of cell phones and PCs and everything else is amazing. Electronics, we had a helmet that maybe cost, what, $10? Today, I guess a helmet must be $1,000 with all electronic gear and whatever armored devices that are associated with it. So it's a very different military, and it's also the very same as well. So it's hard to the big difference, I think, in military is in the Vietnam era, we had a drafting. We had a draft situation, and today we don't have that. It's an all-volunteer military, and I think I've heard 1% of our country is involved in the war, and everybody else is leading their life and doing other things. So that 1%, though, is very actively involved. The families of that 1% probably are just as upset and anxious and concerned as those families that were in other wars as well. So it's a difficult time. Mother's Day probably more so than others.
And certainly when we talk about the families involved today, the men and the women, this being Mother's Day,
who are
involved, some of them coming home to loved ones, some of them coming home in a box.
Right. And those are difficult. You know, the glory is there, certainly. But there's the side effects of these adventures that we get into as a country. Have some long-term effects that are not very positive.
Now, your hero in 228, Lieutenant David Whitehead, does he get to come home?
Well, I left him there. That's, I often talk to my sons and my wife, and I said, you know, maybe I should get them home. Maybe I should write another novel and get them home and get them back into civilian life. So that's in the works. But I left him there. He's about 6 months into his tour. And that was another benefit about Vietnam, is the fact that, you know, you probably got one tour. And if you wanted to be in the military, you probably could get back there within 6 months, or you could extend. Today, these deployments, I've talked to people who've been deployed five times. That's tough. But so was like World War II. I remember working with a guy who had went in the Army in 1941, didn't get out to 1945, and went right through Europe, Italy, into, or went through Africa, Europe, Africa, Italy, and then into mainland Europe in 5 years, and never got home. And of course, you know, today you can make a phone call home. You know, you make a phone call home in 1943, and, well, I don't know how you do that. Then in Vietnam, we had a group called Mars that had a radio system. You could maybe find, if you had an emergency, you could call. But today, it's a very different technology, makes a very different war in many ways, in both armament as well as support systems.
Maybe your next novel in 228 can David Whitehead's adjustment to civilian life again, because that's a major problem, isn't it?
Yeah.
For veterans, who's
For me, it wasn't bad, because I got off the airplane in Seattle, Seattle Tacoma Airport, August 22nd, and I was teaching class September 3rd. That was the best thing for me, to get right back into things, because it, you know, you don't sit around, think about things, you move ahead. And I think that's one of the things that a job satisfies a lot of problems for people, because we identify, you know, it's very hard to, you know, complete the sentence. Who are you? I'm David Washington, and I, if you don't have that item to fill in there, it's very difficult to identify yourself to other people. So I think, and that's one of the problems we have with returning veterans, to make sure they can transition effectively. And for many, it works, and for others, it doesn't work. And some of it stems from the military experience. Some of it stems from a life prior to the military, and that didn't change or didn't or got worse or got better in the military. So it's a our veterans are very complex people. We don't have simple solutions for every one of them. So we have to work with them and deal with them. I see them. I teach a great number of online courses now. I was for many years a college professor, and now I teach online. And many of them are using online, depending on where they might be. Some are deployed. Some are in bases. And they're trying to use this technology to support their academics and seek a little bit being more prepared for when they hit civilian life.
And
it all works together, I guess, the technology of the times.
And I'd like to say thank you to David Weishattle. His new novel, 228, thank you for the novel, for the interview, and for your service to our country. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Peter. I enjoyed it. Thank
My
you
pleasure.
Very much. Take care now.
You too. And it's been WIP Sunday here on 94 WIP Sports Radio. My name's Peter Solomon. Happy Mother's Day to all the women out there, and to all of you who still have your mother. Be good to her. Mine's gone, and I miss her tremendously. Thank you to Phil Jackson, this morning's producer. Couldn't do the show without you. Stay tuned for Sports Talk with Sonny Hill. Always interesting and provocative discussion in the living room. Your opinions, Sonny's reactions. And finally, there's my final thought from the late, great Joan Rivers. Tomorrow's history, yesterday's history, tomorrow's a mystery. Today is the present. That's why we call it a gift from God. Thank you. See you soon.